I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Kansas Supreme Court ruled Monday that the latest school funding plan is inadequate, but they gave the legislature another year to come up with a better budget. This rules out the near-term possibility of a school shutdown, but some Kansas districts are not satisfied. Today we'll get the latest in the long-running Gannon case and find out what the Supreme Court ruling means for Kansas schools, students, and politics. Then, the little-known story of George Washington's runaway slave, Ona Judge. Her escape sent the nation's first president on a relentless manhunt. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Kansas Supreme Court gave a two-word response last week to the legislature's latest school finance funding package. Nice try. Well, they used a few more words than that, but that was the idea. The court said the legislature's $525 million funding boost spread over 5 years wasn't quite good enough. Next January, lawmakers must take another run at the issue. Here to tell us what it all means are David Smith. He's a spokesman for the Kansas City, Kansas School District. David, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good to be here, Steve.
Celia Yopis-Jepson is a reporter with the Kansas News Service based here at KCUR. Celia, good morning.
Good morning.
And also here is Representative Melissa Rooker. She's a Republican from Fairway. Melissa, always good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Celia, set the stage for us here. What did the court rule last week? Because it wasn't all bad news.
No, it wasn't maybe as bad as some people had expected on the way out at the end of the legislative session. Some people were predicting there would be kind of an emergency summer legislative session to add more money immediately for this school year. Instead, what the court said is that they do want more money added, but the amount for this school year is okay. And that gives the legislature time to come back next year during its regular session and add more.
So the way the money is divided up and parceled out to the different districts was ruled to be okay or constitutional. It's the amount of money being spent that's at issue here.
That's exactly right. And that's pretty significant because, as people will remember, there are two parts of the case. One is whether there's enough money overall. The other is, are we being fair in the way that we divide up that money? And over again in the past, the court did find that, no, Kansas is not doing enough to make sure that poorer school districts in terms of their tax resources have what they need. And now this time they said that we're okay on that front.
And this verdict was somewhat anticipated, right? A lot of lawmakers seem to think this might be where things wound up.
I mean, I think that's a good question maybe for Representative Rooker. I've been wondering if this is what she expected.
Was it?
Yes,
it is.
Because,
Well, I mean, a lot of us knew that the money would be questionable, and we've been criticized, frankly, for voting for a $522 million package on top of the prior year. It's a total of $823 million. But we felt like it was imperative on that last day of the regular session with the Senate filibustering that we move this through and get it to the court, and then we had to fix a mistake that was made. But getting the package to the court was all about whether or not schools would be open today, quite frankly. So yes, a lot of us anticipated an order that would tell us to do a little bit more on the funding front, but I'm delighted that the equity piece has been ruled constitutional. I think that's a very significant deal.
So, Representative Rooker, what are you saying then to your constituents who are looking at you and saying $525 million over 5 years wasn't enough in addition to what you increased it the year before? I mean, what do you say to people who are saying, isn't $525 million enough?
Well, the court said that principal amount is calculated based on a premise that they're finding acceptable, that we look back to the Montoy settlement that they agreed was legal and make inflation adjustments. But what they told us is that we didn't account for inflation appropriately. So go recalculate that and make that adjustment, and that they have deemed the premise of the settlement substantially based in the right logic, so to speak.
David Smith, again, you're with the KCK School District. Your district was one of the original plaintiffs in this case. What do you say to that, this notion that $525 million wasn't enough?
Well, I think we have to remember that as schools across the state, we're recovering from almost 10 years of significant declines in state funding. So you can't look at it only in terms of one calendar year. You have to understand schools are behind. Schools have been struggling ever since the Great Recession and then the tax cuts of 2012. So now we're talking about rebuilding that. And it was obvious, I think, to the lawyers for the plaintiffs that not including inflation was going to be a problem. If you look at the total amount of state spending, inflation probably adds another $75 to $100 million a year. And waiting for 5 years to kick in inflation probably wasn't going to pass the test.
So does the court order, David, say that inflation has to be a factor going forward, that has to be built into any annual appropriation for public education?
That's correct. And that's really meaningful because we've never had that before. And it was always frustrating where you would get to a constitutional amount, but then immediately begin to see it eroded by inflation. So that's a pretty important point.
If I may point out that we did build that factor into the plan to begin when the five-year funding phase-in ended, we have the inflation factor built into the law. The court is asking us not to wait, to move that inflation factor up front and put it in now.
You know, but the court, Celia, said the legislature could settle this next session. I thought there had been a lot of talk prior to this that this matter was going to have to be resolved prior to June 30th, just last week.
Well, yeah, I mean, the court did say that they would weigh in on this. I mean, resolve it in a way by June 30th. But I think they see this as reading the ruling as a very reasonable conclusion, because the legislature has put in a significant amount of money. As Representative Rooker mentioned, there was $300 million that they signed off on last year. And so you add the half, more than half a billion this year. I think the court felt that it was reasonable to give more time to resolve the next step. But they're not letting them off the hook. And what's going to be really interesting is to see going forward whether the court, let's say next year, the legislature adds the amount that's required for inflation. Then what happens after that? Does the court retain jurisdiction and see, will this five-year plan actually be carried through? Because you may recall from the 2000s, there was a multi-year plan that was a settlement in a lawsuit that Representative Rooker just mentioned. And that was not carried through because then the Great Recession hit. So, but the court no longer had jurisdiction at that point.
The court had backed away in the mid part of the first decade of this century. Yeah,
right.
David, you know, was there some tension and some drama going into the ruling last week? Because, again, there was talk that if this all wasn't resolved by June 30th, there was the prospect of schools perhaps shutting down, not opening for the fall semester.
I think that most of us who've been following the case, once we got past the first week of June, felt like schools were not going to be shut down. We felt like if the court was going to tell the legislature that it needed to do more this session, then they would have had to have given them the time. By the time we got to mid-June, there was no possible way to have a special session. So at that point, we assumed that the legislature, if they were told to do more, they would have more time to do it.
So in the meantime, though, David, this $525 million over 5 years, that amount's going to kick in, and that's what schools are going to work off of going forward now.
Right. So the amount for next year has already been set, and then the legislature will obviously have work to do to come back and to add inflation for the following years.
Representative Rooker, what kind of break is this for lawmakers who now won't have to come back and mess with this in an election year, which would have been pretty tough?
It would have been tough. It's also important to remember that there's not a true method of funding that you could enact to put, you know, the plaintiff request was $500 million additional dollars before June 30th. We don't have that kind of instant funding to put into it. School districts are entering contracts, and they largely have plans for the upcoming school year in place. So I think it's healthy for everybody that we can all take a breath, we can relax. There's still a lot of questions that need answering. I've already been working with our revisers to unpack the detail of the ruling. And there are a variety of ways to they've told us the total amount of new money needs to be adjusted for inflation, but they haven't prescribed how we inject that into the system. So there are a lot of questions that need answering. So I appreciate having the time. As far as the election cycle, I think it gives voters a chance to weigh in and make choices. If you appreciate the work that those of us who have been fighting for so long to get proper funding into schools have been doing, terrific. We need your vote because every member of the House is up for election.
Yeah.
Who you choose for governor will matter. They're all telling us what their views are on school finance. It's important to listen to that very carefully and make that decision.
You know, if lawmakers need to inject another $60 or $80 or $100 million in to account for inflation, Melissa Rooker, is there money sitting around in, you know, that can be used to fill that? Because I guess there is another dose of good news here, and that revenues are up a little bit.
Revenues
right?
are up. The opportunity exists to employ good common sense, rational thinking, some temperance with what we do across the state budget. We have to continue making forward progress in a lot of different budget areas. The weekend uprising at the prison is indicative, most likely, of the overcrowded conditions. So there is a lot of work to do there and other agencies across the spectrum. A lot of it will help children getting DCF and foster care up to where they need to be, helping with mental health services and a whole variety of things. But yes, I think the revenues exist to put a very responsible plan in place that will phase in the funding we're required to phase in while not overlooking and neglecting the other areas of the budget.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the Kansas Supreme Court's ruling last week in the Gannon case. It has to do with Kansas school funding. If you have questions about this issue, we have a great panel here to help you. 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Melissa Rooker, how confident are you that lawmakers will back more money for schools next year? And I guess what I'm wondering is, to what extent will all of this depend on the results of this year's elections?
I think it rests on the results of this year's elections. Will we need a simple majority of 63 in the House and 21 in the Senate, or will we have a governor whose veto we are required to override with 84 and 27, which is a much, much steeper hill to climb? So it matters that those of us that have been working to put more money and resources in the right places have support from the voters who care about these issues.
David Smith, elections matter, really?
They absolutely do.
Yeah.
The court was very clear. This legislature did really difficult work and some heavy lifting. That needs to continue, and who's sitting in those seats makes all the difference.
How satisfied, David, is the KCK district with the outcome, at least to this point, of this case?
It's a good outcome, not just for us, but I think for schools across the state. One of the things I've always tried to argue with support from my boss is that this is not about just KCK. This is about a school finance system that works for all districts across the state. And sometimes we get caught up in what's happening in our metro area, and we forget a lot of the districts, most of the districts in the state are small. The median size is 550 kids. In those places, even a little bit more money may make the difference between having an aid and not having an aid, which really makes a difference for kids. So we think that we've dealt with issues of equity and adequacy. Obviously, we might argue for more funding, but this is a good result, and we're pleased with it.
You know, we're just sitting here talking in these very round terms of, you know, this money coming into different schools around the state. How much more money will KCK get, and what do you do with it? How are you going to spend that money?
Sure. For us, for next year, we expect slightly over $5 million, about $1.5 million of that is special education money.
And that's roughly what percent of your budget?
That's 1.5%, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not, I mean,
not huge.
But it matters. And after going almost a decade of really not being able to give meaningful raises, I think a lot of those resources will be turned into raises for staff. We have to compete not just with our sister districts in Kansas, but across the state line. If we can't pay teachers well, and we know that generally teachers aren't paid what they're worth in terms of the work that they do and the amount of education they have. So being able to give at least some raise is critically important. We also, because we serve students who have the least advantages, we need to provide experiences for our kids that will help to prepare them for college and careers. And this allows us to have the staff and the resources to give them those experiences.
Experiences like what? What are you talking about?
At the high school level, if you're going to be, I think about my own children who have come with me to work many times. They see what it's like to function in a work environment and how I work. A lot of our kids don't have that. If your parent works in a factory or some other place where you can't bring your child to work, then you need some other opportunity to experience that, be it an internship or a job shadow. We start in middle school by taking kids out to various work experiences and giving them real life experiences.
Yeah. Celia Yopis-Jepson, again, with the Kansas News Service. Do you expect or do you have any sense yet that this extra money, a lot of it's going to go towards teacher salaries? We've seen teacher uprisings, teacher unrest across the country based on teachers feeling they're not being paid enough. Is that a likely outcome here?
I think it is that we have seen that in money that has come from the Gannon court case so far. A good chunk has gone to teacher pay for the reason that there are school districts that say that they're struggling to fill their positions. I mean, we do have an issue in particular in certain parts of the state, including urban school districts, of unfilled positions. I would guess that, let's see, your school district, David, this year had special education vacancies, science and math, I think, as well.
That's exactly right. Those are the areas in which we struggle. And we try to do a lot of creative things to manage that. But it's always a challenge for us. We're not, as a state, as a nation, we're not producing enough special education teachers. We're not producing enough teachers in math and science. And districts like ours that don't have the same resources really struggle to attract those teachers.
Now, it is worth mentioning that Kansas is not the only state dealing with teacher shortages. And there are questions about, is salary the way to fix it, or are there other factors involved? But I would think that for a lot of superintendents, teacher pay is going to be a priority.
You know, Representative Rooker, I'm wondering if lawmakers actually approve more money next spring and they meet and the court signs off on that. Is that going to be the end of this litigation, which has gone on for so many years and that so many candidates for governor are really aiming at and saying it needs to end and end soon?
It can be, as long as we live up to the promise we make in the legislation we pass, that potentially ends it. That's what happened in the prior lawsuit. The court accepted our plan. They said, you have met the constitutional duty, and they dismissed the case. The reason Gannon was filed is we cut the budget 5 times in the 2009 fiscal year and left schools hanging. We never made it to the Montoy goal. So this Gannon case, I liken to contempt of court proceedings for you or I. If we have entered a court settlement and we don't live up to it, we get hauled back into court and held in contempt, right?
Yeah.
That's the Gannon lawsuit. Because the case had been dismissed, Gannon was filed to hold the state accountable for the promises made in Montoy. So if we make new promises in Gannon, the court accepts, we need to live up to them. And then there's nothing to haul us back into court over.
But you would still expect the court to maintain jurisdiction going forward and keep an eye on the legislature, keep a hammer over the legislature for the next few years to come.
Well, I think given our track record, that's probably a likely result.
Just one final point here before we wrap up this conversation. There's still a lot of talk about a constitutional amendment that would bar the courts from having any say over school spending going forward. The amendment would completely remove the courts from the equation. Some prominent lawmakers, including the House Speaker Ron Reichman, are supporting this idea. Celia, where does this stand?
Well, I think this is where it's interesting to think not only about how the ruling we just got is going to affect the upcoming elections in terms of, you know, where candidates stand on their positions and what positions they decide to take based on that ruling, but also how the outcome of the elections will affect the future of the court case. Because right now, it seems that there are not votes in the current legislature to pass out. So there are two steps with amending the Constitution, right? You need to first get it out of the legislature, and that requires
two-thirds
in each house, chamber, yeah. Right? And then you go to the public vote. Well, that would require a yes vote from people like Representative Rooker, who's sitting here, who I think is very uninterested in that prospect. So they do not have the votes right now. Now, what will happen? What will, you know, how will things shake out in the election is going to be interesting to watch.
So, Representative Rooker, your sense is that the votes aren't there in the House right now to pass this constitutional amendment.
Right now, I know the votes are not there in the House.
But after November, that could change.
Depends on the makeup of the House, which is why our House races are so critical. Every House member is up for re-election.
And that November really matters
absolutely.
A whole lot. Okay. We'll leave our conversation there. I want to thank David Smith, spokesman for the KCK School District, soon moving over to the Shawnee Mission District. David, congratulations on the new job. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
Celia Yopis-Jepson is with the Kansas News Service. Celia, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Representative Melissa Rooker, always good to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about George Washington's runaway slave and his determination to bring her back. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, we learned about the 20-year life expectancy gap between black and white Americans and why being black in this country is a health hazard. Find out more at kcur.org/up-to-date. Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach came to national attention for his hardline stance on immigration and voter ID laws. Candidate Kobach joins us tomorrow to talk about his bid to become governor of the Sunflower State. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Ona Judge was a slave, but not just anybody's slave. She belonged to a man named George Washington, which gave Ona Judge a life like few other slaves. She was with the president and the first lady in New York and Philadelphia, and then Ona Judge made a fateful decision. She escaped and would live for another 50 years, even though much of that time was spent with her head turned over her shoulder. Turns out the nation's first president was determined to get her back. Ona Judge's story is told in a compelling new book, now out in paperback, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. The book was a finalist for the National Book Award for Nonfiction, and its author is Erica Armstrong Dunbar, who's the Charles and Mary Beard Professor of History at Rutgers University. Erica, so nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, I thought George Washington freed his slaves. At least that's the popular perception out there. If that's the case, why did he pursue Ona Judge so aggressively?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we do know, or folks mostly know, that George Washington, upon his death, did offer the emancipation of his slaves, but of his slaves, the ones that he had purchased, the slaves that he had inherited as a young boy at the age of 10, 11 years old. However, this did not include the slaves who were purchased and inherited by Martha Washington.
Hmm.
And technically, Ona Judge, although raised and controlled by the first president, technically she belonged to the estate of Martha Washington.
And that estate was Mount Vernon. And I'm wondering, is it safe to say that if Ona Judge had stayed at Mount Vernon in Virginia instead of being forced to go to Philadelphia and New York with the new president, that she likely would never have made a dash for freedom?
Well, we don't know if she never would have made a dash for freedom. What we know is that her proximity to the ability to live as a free person in New York or Philadelphia, you know, she had access. She had access to the North, a place in which slavery was on its deathbed. She had access to, if she wanted, to sort of think about Canada later on. So I think what we know is that it was much easier for her to imagine a life as a fugitive, a life that included a successful escape. That would have been much more difficult had she stayed in Virginia.
Yeah, the fact that she was not free in Philadelphia, where then President Washington was governing the country, that made her something of an outlier just in and of itself, right?
Yeah, it did. When George Washington was elected president, of course, he first arrived in New York, but in 1790, they moved to Philadelphia, where the nation's capital would sit for 10 years. And when he went, he took with him 9 enslaved people, and Ona Judge was one of them. When she lived or arrived in Philadelphia, she arrived to a city that had the largest free black population anywhere in the new country, thousands of free people. And with only maybe 100 enslaved or so people left. So she was in the minority. She was in many ways the oddball as an enslaved person. And the fact that her owners were the first family made it a sort of a very difficult and precarious situation for the Washingtons and for her.
So she's looking around and meeting new people, and she's wondering, what the heck am I doing in a situation like this?
Yeah, she could. Of course, we don't know her exact thoughts from mm-hmm. that moment, because she didn't leave a record from that at that time. But of course, she was walking around. She could see freedom as we move into this July 4th holiday. I think it's important to think about at this moment when Philadelphia and the nation was celebrating freedom, what would someone like Ona Judge be thinking as an enslaved person, enslaved to the president, walking around literally living within a stone's throw of Independence Hall? Hmm. How could she not have imagined her life as a free person?
Let's go back to her life at Mount Vernon. What was it like for her there?
Yeah. So we know that Ona was born sometime between 1773 and 74. We don't have an exact date because the Washingtons did not keep birth dates or records of the births of enslaved people. And so she's born really at the beginning of the sort of revolutionary era. She's born to an enslaved woman named Betty, who was technically owned by Martha Washington. She was a seamstress and a spinner. And her father was a white indentured servant named Andrew Judge, who George Washington had purchased his indenture agreement in 1772 and brought him to Mount Vernon. He was a tailor. Betty was a seamstress. We do not know the nature of their engagement or relationship. What we do know is that Ona Judge was born. Her surname was recorded in the records at Mount Vernon, one of the very few enslaved who had a last name. And so I was able to sort of tie her to Andrew Judge, as well as descriptions of what she looked like. She was mixed race. And so she grew up at Mount Vernon. At the age of 10, she was taken up to the Mansion House, where she would really begin her life, her duty as an enslaved person. And she was to learn to be a seamstress and a spinner like her mother. And at some point, Martha Washington took a liking to her, at least realized that she was a competent and useful person. And, you know, I'm still struggling with a term for this, but basically makes Ona her top slave. Hmm. And she really places upon her the responsibilities, intimate responsibilities of helping her bathe, making her clothing.
So she was very important to Martha Washington particularly then.
Indeed, yes.
And that suggests why George and Martha Washington would have taken her with them from Mount Vernon first to New York and then to Philadelphia.
Exactly. When they traveled to New York, they actually took 7 enslaved people. And at that moment, New York's enslaved population was much larger than Philadelphia, than Pennsylvania's. And so it wasn't as odd to bring enslaved people to New York. It was to Philadelphia.
And they went to New York first because the nation's capital, at least originally, was there before it moved to Philly.
Correct. I kind of owe a debt of gratitude to Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's now taught all my college students, at least, that the nation's capital was in New York first.
Before we go any further, not only are you telling a story that is more than two centuries old, which presents its own challenges, you're telling a story about a subject who very intentionally shrouded her life in secrecy. First, tell us about that secrecy and why it was so important to her.
Yeah, that secrecy really sort of frames her life. From the moment that she makes the decision that she is going to escape, it's a sort of careful and well thought out plan to leave Philadelphia. And she had her reasons. And when she made that decision to leave, she knew that according to the law signed by her owner, George Washington, the fugitive slave law allowed those who owned slaves to cross lines, state lines, and to collect their slaves no matter where they went. So although she escaped from the president's house on May 21st, 1796, she was not free. She was never free. She lived as a fugitive for nearly half a century, literally looking over her shoulders, waiting for the Washingtons and their heirs to come and find her.
So what was available for you in terms of research? I mean, what's out there? And I'm just wondering about the challenge you faced in reconstructing this life of Ona Judge.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think for those historians who work on slavery, who work on, in particular, the lives of enslaved women, it's difficult in the archives that typically our folks aren't represented because the enslaved were forbidden from learning to read or write. So in terms of leaving their letters or diaries, those things behind, there are much fewer of those sources. However, George Washington kept wonderful records. And so much of what I was able to find at first actually came from the first president's pen. He recorded and wrote about Ona, about his attempt to find her, to capture her, to bring her back. I know from the record books at Mount Vernon, as well as the president's house here in Philadelphia, I know when they bought stockings for her, when she had shoes. And then at the end of Ona's life, she left behind two very important interviews. She gave an interview to the Granite Freeman in 1845, which was an abolitionist newspaper for New Hampshire. And then she gave a sort of national interview for the Liberator, the sort of most well-known abolitionist newspaper in the nation. So this, of course, is at the end of her life. But what those interviews allowed me to do was to compare and contrast and connect them to the writings of George Washington and the people connected to Washington in order to tease out her life. It is not easy work. Our folks are, you know, people like Ona Judge aren't in the archives in the traditional ways that our founding fathers are. And so, but telling her story allows me and allows readers to learn about, to think about the founding of the nation, not through the typical lens of George Washington or a Thomas Jefferson, but to think about the founding of the nation through the eyes of the enslaved.
Right. Erica Armstrong Dunbar is my guest. Her book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. You know, there's a telling moment in this story when the Washingtons are in Philadelphia and they realize suddenly, actually, that they are close to a deadline that will result in some of the slaves automatically being freed, including Ona Judge. What happened there and how did the Washingtons respond?
Yeah, this was a sort of difficult moment in 1791. George Washington was off on a trip to the southern states, and Martha was at home alone and received a visit from the Attorney General, who basically told her that they were in risk, they were in serious trouble of losing all of the slaves that they had brought with them to Philadelphia, that the laws in Pennsylvania stated that non-residents who brought enslaved people with them to Pennsylvania could only keep them there for 6 months. And if they stayed longer than 6 months, those enslaved people had the right to be set free. And so Martha Washington is told this information, and she, along with George Washington's secretary, Tobias Lear, they're nervous. I mean, they're at risk of losing all of the enslaved. And so they write to George Washington, and I consulted this letter that he returned to them, where he basically comes up with a slave rotation plan. And he tells Martha and he tells Tobias Lear, his secretary, every 6 months we will rotate our slaves out of Pennsylvania back to Virginia. And if that's too problematic, a quick trip to Trenton across the river to New Jersey could basically do the same work of resetting the clock on slavery. So this is a moment when you're reading, you know, a letter penned by the first president of the United States. And it's clear he's not necessarily breaking the law, but he's breaking the spirit of the law in Pennsylvania in order to keep his enslaved men and women in the status of slavery.
Oona was Martha Washington's personal maid, as we've talked about here. So as what were her duties at that point in her life as she's now working for the first lady in the history of the country?
Yeah, you know, as an 18th century slave, her duties were difficult very sort of specific to someone like Martha Washington, who was a sort of up-and-coming person. Martha Washington was actually a wealthy woman by the time she married George Washington. She had been widowed and had a great deal of land as well as money and a significant number of enslaved people. She actually had much more wealth than George Washington when they married. And so for her, at Mount Vernon, she lived a life as a sort of genteel country woman. And this required someone to, as I said before, help her with the kind of everyday needs of a farmer and a wealthy one. But that would require making not only Martha Washington's clothes, but clothes for the rest of men and women who were living at Mount Vernon, including the enslaved. Learning to spin, learning to do the domestic work that many enslaved women were forced to do. So that's laundry. That's one thing that I don't believe she was responsible for doing was cooking. There was a very kind of elaborate staff of those who were responsible for cooking. In part, you know, this was important for George Washington, someone who struggled with dental issues for much of his adult life. He had to have staff who knew how to cook food that he could consume, that he could macerate without, really without teeth. And so that's one of the responsibilities that Ono did not have. She was really Martha Washington's top slave. That meant making her clothing, preparing her clothing, helping her bathe, brushing her hair, helping her prepare for bedtime. And once they moved to New York and Philadelphia, it also meant that Ona was on stage. She went everywhere that Martha went. If she went on a social call, Ona would go with her. And so by the 1790s, Ona's face is a well-known face in the city of brotherly love. If you knew Martha Washington, if you were her acquaintance at least, you knew the freckle-faced woman who traveled with her everywhere.
So Ona is working hard for the First Lady, and it was interesting to me, the living quarters in Philadelphia for all these different people, we're talking about pretty cramped conditions here.
Yeah, when we think about sort of our modern understanding of what a White House or what a presidential home should look like. It was very different at the end of the 18th century. There were so many servants and slaves, as well as family members, at the president's home in Philadelphia that it was packed. There were 24, 25 people living in a three-story home that was large for the 18th century, but very, very cramped, even for the Washingtons. So this idea of privacy, really didn't exist. So any of the sort of talk or rumors could be spread very quickly at the president's house.
So what kind of owners were the Washingtons? Were they kind? Were they mean, demanding? How do you categorize them?
Yeah, you know, I think typically many have categorized the Washingtons with this term of the sort of benevolent slave owner. And I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that means.
What does that mean? Yeah.
Because if you own a slave, I'm not quite certain what it means to be benevolent. But they did not, the Washingtons didn't have per se a sort of reputation for being extremely sort of physically punishing or volatile. But we do know from the records that they sold slaves. They sold slaves that were that they conceived or thought of as difficult or unwilling to follow the rules. George Washington gave permission to his estate manager and to others to beat his slaves. And so, you know, I think it's important that we remember there are all kinds of sort of ways to construct the Washingtons as slave owners. I think the most important people to have consulted on that were the enslaved themselves. And Ona sort of talks about the Washingtons in her interviews and really does not paint them as godly people, as benevolent people. Yet and still, she made the decision to stay with them for many years in Philadelphia. And it wasn't really until towards the end of George Washington's second term in office that she made the decision to flee.
We'll talk about that now. Again, my guest, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, the book Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. She escaped during a presidential dinner, no less. This happened shortly after she had been given news that would affect her future. What was that news and how did she escape?
Yeah, Ona, she finds out, we're not quite certain how she uncovers this information, but she finds out that she, after, you know, many years of working for the Washingtons, she's about 22 at this age, at this moment, she finds out that she's going to be given away as a wedding gift to Martha Washington's granddaughter, Eliza Park Custis. And everyone who knew Eliza knew that she was a difficult woman. That she was someone who was volatile, had a temper. Now, part of this also, I think, is the way people thought 18th century women should behave. And Eliza was someone who did not conform to those regulations. She spoke her mind, including her decision to marry quickly a man that they knew the Washingtons did not know. He was 20 years older than she. It was a sort of fast and furious relationship. And she made the decision to marry. And Martha Washington was concerned. She knew that her granddaughter was difficult and rash. And so she said, let me give her the best possible help that I can give. And that was Ona. So Martha made the decision to give Ona to Eliza, this difficult granddaughter, who was about Ona's age. And to go and to live and work with her for the rest of her life. And so this is the moment that triggers in Ona's mind. It reminds her that no matter how close she may have thought she was to Martha Washington, mm-hmm. no matter how much she had sort of displayed her loyalty and honesty and her assistance and how competent she was, it didn't matter. She was the property of Martha Washington, and she was property that could be mortgaged or bartered or traded or given to whomever Martha Washington wished, and that included her granddaughter. And so when Ona hears that she's going to be given away, that is the moment that she decides, I cannot do this. I cannot leave. It's what pulls the trigger on her decision to escape.
How did she escape, and where did she go?
So, you know, one thing that's interesting about Ona and her story is that, you know, she runs away at the end of the 18th century. This is before any kind of organized Underground Railroad, right? That's a very kind of 19th century construction of kind of barns and caverns and caves and people who were sort of willing and prepared to help fugitives. Nonetheless, she still did it, as did many others. And she made the decision to run, and she did so with the help of the free Black community in Philadelphia. She says in her interview that she actually prepared to leave. She packed her things ahead of time, that she sent them to members of the free Black community. She never gives names because this, of course, was a violation of federal law to help a fugitive. She sends her clothing to friends ahead of time. And while the Washingtons were eating their supper, a responsibility that Ona would never have had, she took that moment to escape, and she fled, and she really walked to the Delaware River, which is several blocks from the president's house, and she boarded a ship called the Nancy. And that ship, at the moment, she did not know where she was going. She says in her interview, she wasn't actually told. And that would have made sense. No one would have wanted to give her too much information in case she was caught. If she was caught, she wouldn't be able to reveal sources. But it's clear that the free Black community helped her find this boat that would take her eventually to New England. And so she boarded this ship, left May 21st, 1796, boarded a ship captained by a man named John Bowles, who ferried her to New Hampshire, to Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
God, what a moment that is. You know, this book goes into great detail of the president's determination to get her back. We only have a couple minutes left. I'm wondering, what does this story tell us ultimately about President George Washington? Because, you know, some people have tried to make it seem as if Washington somehow transcended the slavery issue. He hasn't been tagged with it in the same way that Thomas Jefferson has been, for instance. So what does it tell us about George Washington?
Yeah, I think that one of the things I wanted to do with this book and through Ona's life is to give a different story, a story that we don't typically hear about George Washington. Indeed, he did make the decision to emancipate his slaves in his will after the death of Martha Washington. So he was clearly uncomfortable, and clearly his attitudes about slavery changed over time, but he was never willing to live without slavery. He was never willing for his wife to live without slavery. And I think it's important to note that George Washington had no biological children. And in the 18th century, to have a tremendous amount of property via enslaved people, to simply emancipate them while you have a son or a daughter who's expecting to inherit that wealth, that would have been very odd for Washington to have gone on and emancipate so much wealth in the form of human people, human bodies. If he had had children, I don't think he would have done that. Of course, I don't. That's speculation. But we do have to acknowledge through his writings that he wrestled with slavery as he got older, and he made the decision to emancipate his slaves. But this did not mean really anything for Ona. She was Martha Washington's slave, and the Washingtons relentlessly pursue her until the end of their lives.
What a story. Never Caught is the book, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of the Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. The author, Erica Armstrong Dunbar. The book was a finalist for the National Book Award for Nonfiction. Hey, thank you for sharing the story with us. It's an important one for us to hear, and I'm sure glad you wrote the book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again. Last week on the program, a former Kansas Secretary of Agriculture gave us his qualifications for the Kansas Governor's office, including family roots that go back five generations. You can hear that conversation with Josh Swatty at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we're joined by another candidate, Chris Kobach. He's the Republican frontrunner in what's shaping up to be a close Kansas gubernatorial primary race. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.